Chapter 29. The Allied Invasion of Western Europe and the Attempt to Kill Hitler. The conspirators had made at least half a dozen attempts to assassinate Hitler during 1943, one of which had miscarried only when a time bomb planted in the Führer's airplane during a flight behind the Russian front failed to explode. A considerable change had taken place that year in the resistance movement, such as it was. The plotters had finally given up on the field marshals. They were simply too cowardly or thick-headed to use their position and military power to overthrow their supreme warlord. At a secret meeting in November 1942 in the forest of Smolensk, Goerdeler, the political spark plug of the resistors, had pleaded personally with Field Marshal von Kluge, the commander of Army Group Center in the East, to take an active part in getting rid of Hitler. The unstable general, who had just accepted a handsome gift from the Führer, assented, but a few days later got cold feet and wrote to General Beck in Berlin to count him out. On his 60th birthday, October 30, 1942, Kluge received from the Führer a check for 250,000 marks, $100,000 at the official rate of exchange, and a special permit to spend half of it on the improvement of his estate. Notwithstanding this insult to his honesty and honor as a German officer, the field marshal accepted both. Schlabrendorf, They Almost Killed Hitler, page 40. Later, when Kluge turned against Hitler, the Führer told his officers at headquarters, "I personally promoted him twice, gave him the highest decorations, gave him a large estate, and a large supplement to his pay as field marshal." Gilbert, Hitler Directs His War, pages 101 to 102. A stenographic account of Hitler's conference at headquarters on August 31, 1944. A few weeks later, the plotters tried to induce General Paulus, whose Sixth Army was surrounded at Stalingrad, and who, they presumed, was bitterly disillusioned with the leader who had made this possible, to issue an appeal to the army to overthrow the tyrant who had condemned 250,000 German soldiers to such a ghastly end. A personal appeal from General Beck to Paulus to do this was flown into the beleaguered city by an Air Force officer. Paulus, as we have seen, responded by sending a flood of radio messages of devotion to his Führer, experiencing an awakening only after he got to Moscow in Russian captivity. For a few days, the conspirators, disappointed by Paulus, pinned their hopes on Kluge and Manstein, who, after the disaster of Stalingrad, were flying to Rostenburg, it was understood, to demand that the Führer turn over command of the Russian front to them. If successful, this démarche was to be a signal for a coup d'état in Berlin. Once again, the plotters were victims of their wishful thinking. The two field marshals did fly to Hitler's headquarters, but only to reaffirm their loyalty to the supreme commander. "We are deserted," Beck complained bitterly. It was obvious to him and his friends that they could expect no practical aid from the senior commanders at the front. In desperation, they turned to the only remaining source of military power, the Ersatzheer, the home or replacement army, which was scarcely an army at all but a collection of recruits in training and various garrison troops of overage men performing guard duty in the homeland. But at least its men were armed, and with the fit troops and the Waffen-SS units far away at the front, it might be sufficient to enable the conspirators to occupy Berlin and certain other key cities at the moment of Hitler's assassination. But on the necessity, or even the desirability, of that lethal act, the opposition was still not entirely agreed. The Kreisau Circle, for instance, was unalterably opposed to any such act of violence. This was a remarkable, heterogeneous group of young intellectual idealists gathered around the scions of two of Germany's most renowned and aristocratic families, Count Helmut James von Moltke, a great-great-nephew of the field marshal who had led the Prussian army to victory over France in 1870, and Count Peter York von Wartenburg, a direct descendant of the famous general of the Napoleonic era, who, with Clausewitz, had signed the Convention of Tauroggen with Tsar Alexander I, by which the Prussian army changed sides and helped bring the downfall of Bonaparte. Taking its name from the Moltke estate at Kreisau in Silesia, the Kreisau Circle was not a conspiratorial body but a discussion group, whose members represented a cross-section of German society as it had been in the pre-Nazi times, and as they hoped it would be when the Hitlerite nightmare had passed. "We are to be hanged," Moltke wrote to his wife just before his execution, for thinking together. It included two Jesuit priests, two Lutheran pastors, conservatives, liberals, socialists, wealthy landowners, former trade union leaders, professors, and diplomats. Despite the differences in their backgrounds and thoughts, they were able to find a broad common ground which enabled them to provide the intellectual, spiritual, ethical, philosophical, and, to some extent, political ideas of the resistance to Hitler. Judging by the documents which they have left, almost all of these men were hanged before the war's end, which included plans for the future government and for the economic, social, and spiritual foundations of the new society. What they aimed at was a sort of Christian socialism in which all men would be brothers and the terrible ills of modern times, the perversions of the human spirit, would be cured. Their ideals were noble, high in the white clouds, and to them was added a touch of German mysticism. But these high-minded young men were unbelievably patient. They hated Hitler and all the degradation he had brought on Germany and Europe. But they were not interested in overthrowing him. They thought Germany's coming defeat would accomplish that. They turned their attention exclusively to the thereafter. "To us," Moltke wrote at the time, "Europe after the war is a question of how the picture of man can be re-established in the breasts of our fellow citizens." Dorothy Thompson, the distinguished American journalist who had been stationed for many years in Germany and knew it well, appealed to Moltke, an old and close friend of hers, to come down from the mountaintop. In a series of shortwave broadcasts from New York during the summer of 1942, addressed to Hans, she begged him and his friends to do something to get rid of the demonic dictator. "We are not living in a world of saints, but of human beings," she tried to remind him. "The last time we met, Hans, and drank tea together on that beautiful terrace before the lake, I said that one day you would have to demonstrate by deeds, drastic deeds, where you stood. And I remember that I asked you whether you and your friends would ever have the courage to act." It was a penetrating question, and the answer seems to have turned out to be that Moltke and his friends had the courage to talk, for which they were executed, but not to act. This flaw in their minds rather than in their hearts, for all of them met their cruel deaths with great bravery, was the main cause of the differences between the Kreisau Circle and the Beck-Girdler-Hassel group of conspirators, though they also were in dispute about the nature and the makeup of the government which was to take over from the Nazi regime. There were several meetings between them following a full-dress conference at the home of Peter York on January 22, 1943, presided over by General Beck, who, as Hassel reported in his diary, was rather weak and reserved. A spirited argument developed between the youngsters and the oldsters, Hassel's terms, over future economic and social policy, with Moltke clashing with Girdler. Hassel thought the former mayor of Leipzig was quite reactionary and noted Moltke's Anglo-Saxon and pacifist inclinations. The Gestapo also took note of this meeting and at the subsequent trials of the participants turned up a surprisingly detailed account of the discussions. Himmler was already closer on the trail of the conspirators than any of them realized. But it is one of the ironies of this narrative that at this point in 1943, with the prospect of victory lost and of defeat imminent, the mild-mannered, bloodthirsty SS Führer, the master policeman of the Third Reich, began to take a personal and not altogether unfavorable interest in the resistance, with which he had more than one friendly contact. And it is indicative of the mentality of the plotters that more than one of them, Puppets especially, began to see in Himmler a possible replacement for Hitler. The SS chief, so seemingly fanatically loyal to the Führer, began to see this himself, but until almost the end played a double game in the course of which he snuffed out the life of many a gallant conspirator. The resistance was now working in three fields. The Kreisau Circle was holding its endless talks to work out the millennium. The Beck group, more down to earth, was striving in some way to kill Hitler and take over power. And it was making contact with the West in order to apprise the Democratic allies of what was up and to inquire what kind of peace they would negotiate with a new anti-Nazi government. These contacts were made in Stockholm and in Switzerland. It is said in some of the German memoirs that in 1942 and 1943, the Nazis were in contact with the Russians about a possible peace negotiation, and even that Stalin had offered to initiate talks for a separate peace. Ribbentrop on the stand at Nuremberg made a good deal of his own efforts to get in touch with the Russians and said he actually made contact with Soviet agents at Stockholm. Peter Kleist, who acted for Ribbentrop in Stockholm, had told of this in his book. I suspect that when all the secret German papers are sorted, a revealing chapter on this episode may come to light. In the Swedish capital, Gerdler often saw the bankers Marcus and Jakob Wallenberg, with whom he had long been friends and who had intimate business and personal contacts in London. At one meeting in April 1942 with Jakob Wallenberg, Gerdler urged him to get in touch with Churchill. The conspirators wanted in advance an assurance from the Prime Minister that the Allies would make peace with Germany if they arrested Hitler and overthrew the Nazi regime. Wallenberg replied that from what he knew of the British government, no such assurance was possible. A month later, two Lutheran clergymen made direct contact with the British in Stockholm. These were Dr. Hans Schoenfeld, a member of the Foreign Relations Bureau of the German Evangelical Church, and Pastor Dietrich Bonhoeffer, an eminent divine and an active conspirator, who, on hearing that Dr. George Bell, the Anglican Bishop of Chichester, was visiting in Stockholm, hastened there to see him. Bonhoeffer, traveling incognito on forged papers provided him by Colonel Oster of the Abwehr. Both pastors informed the bishop of the plans of the conspirators, and, as had Gerdler, inquired whether the Western Allies would make a decent peace with a non-Nazi government once Hitler had been overthrown. They asked for an answer, by either a private message or a public announcement. To impress the bishop that the anti-Hitler conspiracy was a serious business, Bonhoeffer furnished him with a list of the names of the leaders, an indiscretion which later was to cost him his life and to help make certain the execution of many of the others. This was the most authoritative and up-to-date information the Allies had had on the German opposition and its plans, and Bishop Bell promptly turned it over to Anthony Eden, the British Foreign Secretary, when he returned to London in June. But Eden, who had resigned this post in 1938 in protest against Chamberlain's appeasement of Hitler, was skeptical. Similar information had been conveyed to the British government by alleged German plotters since the time of Munich, and nothing had come of it. No response was made. The German underground's contacts with the Allies in Switzerland were mainly through Alan Dulles, who headed the U.S. Office of Strategic Services there from November 1942 until the end of the war. His chief visitor was Hans Gisevius, who journeyed to Bern frequently from Berlin and who also was an active member of the conspiracy, as we have seen. Gisevius worked for the Abwehr and was actually posted to the German Consulate General in Zurich as vice-consul. His chief function was to convey messages to Dulles from Beck and Gerdler and to keep him informed of the progress of the various plots against Hitler. Other German visitors included Dr. Schoenfeld and Trott zu Sulz, the latter a member of the Kreisau Circle and also of the conspiracy, who once journeyed to Switzerland to warn Dulles, as had so many others, that if the Western democracies refused to consider a decent peace with an anti-Nazi German regime, the conspirators would turn to Soviet Russia. Dulles, though he was personally sympathetic, was unable to give any assurances. One marvels at these German resistance leaders who were so insistent on getting a favorable peace settlement from the West and so hesitant in getting rid of Hitler until they had got it. One would have thought that if they considered Nazism to be such a monstrous evil as they constantly contended, no doubt sincerely, they would have concentrated on trying to overthrow it regardless of how the West might treat their new regime. One gets the impression that a good many of these good Germans fell too easily into the trap of blaming the outside world for their own failures, as some of them had done for Germany's misfortunes after the First Lost War, and even for the advent of Hitler himself. Operation Flash. In February 1943, Gerdler told Jakob Wallenberg in Stockholm that they had plans for a coup in March. They had. The preparations for Operation Flash, as it was called, had been worked out during January and February by General Friedrich Olbricht, chief of the General Army Office, Allgemeines Heeresamt, and General von Treskow, chief of staff of Kluge's Army Group Center in Russia. Olbricht, a deeply religious man, was a recent convert to the conspiracy, but, because of his new post, had rapidly become a key figure in it. As deputy to General Friedrich Fromm, commander of the replacement army, he was in a position to rally the garrisons in Berlin and the other large cities of the Reich behind the plotters. Fromm himself, like Kluge, was by now disillusioned with his Führer, but was not regarded as sufficiently trustworthy to be let in on the plot. "We are ready. It is time for the flash," Obrecht told young Fabian von Schlabrendorf, a junior officer on Tresco's staff at the end of February. Early in March, the plotters met for a final conference at Smolensk, the headquarters of Army Group Center. Although not participating in the action, Admiral Canaris, the chief of the Abwehr, was aware of it and arranged the meeting, flying Hans von Dohnányi and General Erwin Lahausen of his staff with him to Smolensk, ostensibly for a conference of Wehrmacht intelligence officers. Lahausen, a former intelligence officer of the Austrian army and the only plotter in the Abwehr to survive the war, brought along some bombs. Schlabrendorf and Tresco, after much experimenting, had found that German bombs were no good for their purpose. They worked, as the young officer later explained, with a fuse that made a low hissing noise, which gave them away. The British, they discovered, made a better bomb. Prior to the explosion, Schlabrendorf says, they made no noise of any kind. The RAF had dropped a number of these weapons over occupied Europe to Allied agents for sabotage purposes. One had been used to assassinate Heydrich, and the Abwehr had collected several of them and turned them over to the conspirators. The plan worked out at the Smolensk meeting was to lure Hitler to the Army Group headquarters and there do away with him. This would be the signal for the coup in Berlin. Enticing the warlord, who was now suspicious of most of his generals, into the trap was not an easy matter. But Tresco prevailed upon an old friend, General Schmundt, as he now was, adjutant to Hitler, to work on his chief, and after some hesitation and more than one cancellation, the Führer agreed definitely to come to Smolensk on March 13, 1943. Schmundt himself knew nothing of the plot. In the meantime, Tresco had been renewing his efforts to get his chief, Kluge, to take the lead in bumping off Hitler. He suggested to the Field Marshal that Lieutenant Colonel Freiherr von Böselager, executed by the Nazis, who commanded a cavalry unit at headquarters, be allowed to use it to mow Hitler and his bodyguard down when they arrived. Böselager was more than willing. All he needed was an order from the field marshal. But the vacillating commander could not bring himself to give it. Tresco and Schlabrendorf, therefore, decided to take matters into their own hands. They would simply plant one of their British-made bombs in Hitler's plane on its return flight. The semblance of an accident, Schlabrendorf later explained, would avoid the political disadvantages of a murder. For in those days, Hitler still had many followers who, after such an event, would have put up a strong resistance to our revolt. Twice that afternoon and evening of March 13th, after Hitler had arrived, the two anti-Nazi officers were tempted to change their plan and set the bomb off, first in Kluge's personal quarters, where Hitler conferred with the top generals of the army group, and later in the officers' mess, where the gathering supped. At the first meeting, Schlabrendorf says, he had an opportunity to examine Hitler's oversized cap. He was struck by its weight. On examination, it proved to be lined with 3.5 pounds of steel plating. But this would have killed some of the very generals who, once relieved of their personal oaths of allegiance to the Führer, were counted upon to help the conspirators take over power in the Reich. There still remained the task of smuggling the bomb onto the Führer's plane, which was due to take off immediately after dinner. Schlabrendorf had assembled what he calls 2 explosive packets— and made of them 1 parcel which resembled a couple of brandy bottles. During the repast, Tresco had innocently asked a Colonel Heinz Brandt of the Army General Staff, who was in Hitler's party, whether he would be good enough to take back a present of 2 bottles of brandy to his old friend General Helmut Stief, executed by the Nazis, who was chief of the organization branch of the Army High Command. The unsuspecting Brandt said he would be glad to. At the airfield, Schlabrendorf nervously reached through a small opening in his parcel, started the mechanism of the time bomb, and handed it to Brandt as he boarded the Führer's plane. This was a cleverly built weapon. It had no telltale clockwork. When the young officer pressed on a button, it broke a small bottle, releasing a corrosive chemical which then ate away a wire that held back a spring. When the wire gave out, the spring pressed forward the striker, which hit a detonator that exploded the bomb. The crash, Schlabrendorf says, was expected shortly after Hitler's plane passed over Minsk, about 30 minutes flying time from Smolensk. Feverish with excitement, he rang up Berlin and by code informed the conspirators that flash had begun. Then he and Tresco waited with pounding hearts for the great news. They expected the first word would come by radio from one of the fighter planes which was escorting the Führer's plane. They counted off the minutes, 20, 30, 40, an hour, and still there was no word. It came more than 2 hours later. A routine message said that Hitler had landed at Rostenburg. "We were stunned and could not imagine the cause of the failure," Schlabrendorf later recounted. "I immediately rang up Berlin and gave the code word indicating that the attempt had miscarried. Then Tresco and I consulted as to what action to take. We were deeply shaken. It was serious enough that the attempt had not succeeded. But even worse would be the discovery of the bomb, which would unfailingly lead to our detection and the death of a wide circle of close collaborators." The bomb was never discovered. That night, Tresco rang up Colonel Brandt, inquired casually whether he had had time to deliver his parcel to General Stief, and was told by Brandt that he had not yet got around to it. Tresco told him to hold it. There had been a mistake in the bottles, and that Schlabrendorf would be arriving the next day on some official business and would bring the really good brandy that he had intended to send. With incredible courage, Schlabrendorf flew to Hitler's headquarters and exchanged a couple of bottles of brandy for the bomb. "I can still recall my horror," he later related, "when Brandt handed me the bomb and gave it a jerk that made me fear a belated explosion. Feigning a composure I did not feel, I took the bomb, immediately got into a car, and drove to the neighboring railway junction of Korschen. There he caught the night train to Berlin and, in the privacy of his sleeping compartment, dismantled the bomb. He quickly discovered what had happened, or rather, why nothing had happened. The mechanism had worked, the small bottle had broken, the corrosive fluid had consumed the wire, the striker had hit forward, but the detonator had not fired." Bitterly disappointed, but not discouraged, the conspirators in Berlin decided to make a fresh attempt on Hitler's life. A good occasion soon presented itself. Hitler, accompanied by Goering, Himmler, and Keitel, was due to be present at the Heroes' Memorial Day, held in Gedenktag. Ceremonies on March 21st at the Zeughaus in Berlin. Here was an opportunity to get not only the Führer, but his chief associates. As Colonel Freiherr von Gerstorff, chief of intelligence on Kluge's staff, later said, this was a chance which would never recur. Gerstorff had been selected by Tresco to handle the bomb, and this time it would have to be a suicidal mission. The plan was for the colonel to conceal in his overcoat pockets two bombs, set the fuses, stay as close to Hitler during the ceremony as possible, and blow the Führer and his entourage as well as himself to eternity. With conspicuous bravery, Gerstorff readily volunteered to sacrifice his life. On the evening of March 20th, he met with Schlabrendorf in his room at the Aden Hotel in Berlin. Schlabrendorf had brought two bombs with 10-minute fuses. But because of the near-freezing temperature in the glassed-over courtyard of the Zeughaus, it might take from 15 to 20 minutes before the weapons exploded. It was in this courtyard that Hitler, after his speech, was scheduled to spend half an hour examining an exhibition of captured Russian war trophies, which Gerstorff's staff had arranged. It was the only place where the colonel could get close enough to the Führer to kill him. Gerstorff later recounted what happened. The next day I carried in each of my overcoat pockets a bomb with a 10-minute fuse. I intended to stay as close to Hitler as I could, so that he at least would be blown to pieces by the explosion. When Hitler entered the exhibition hall, Schmunt came across to me and said that only 8 or 10 minutes were to be spent on inspecting the exhibits. So the possibility of carrying out the assassination no longer existed, since even if the temperature had been normal, the fuse needed at least 10 minutes. This last-minute change of schedule, which was typical of Hitler's subtle security methods, had once again saved him his life. One of the difficulties of piecing together the deeds of the plotters is that the memories of the few survivors are far from perfect, so that their accounts not only often differ but are contradictory. Schlabrendorf, for example, who had brought the bombs to Gerstorff, recounts in his book that because they could not find a short enough time fuse, the Zeughaus attempt had to be given up. He apparently was unaware or forgot that Gerstorff actually went to the Zeughaus to try to carry out his assignment, though the colonel says that the night before he told him he was determined to do it with the fuses he had. General von Tresco, Gerstorff says, was anxiously and expectantly following the broadcast of the ceremonies from Smolensk, a stopwatch in his hand. When the broadcaster announced that Hitler had left the hall only 8 minutes after he had entered it, the general knew that still another attempt had failed. There were at least three further overcoat attempts at Hitler's life, as the conspirators called them, and each, as we shall see, was similarly frustrated. Early in 1943, there was one spontaneous uprising in Germany which, though small in itself, helped to revive the flagging spirits of the resistance, whose every attempt to remove Hitler had been thus far thwarted. It also served as a warning of how ruthless the Nazi authorities could be in putting down the least sign of opposition. The university students in Germany, as we have seen, had been among the most fanatical of Nazis in the early 30s, but 10 years of Hitler's rule had brought disillusionment, and this was sharpened by the failure of Germany to win the war, and particularly, as 1943 came, by the disaster at Stalingrad. The University of Munich, the city that had given birth to Nazism, became the hotbed of student revolt. It was led by a 25-year-old medical student, Hans Scholl, and his 21-year-old sister, Sophia, who was studying biology. Their mentor was Kurt Huber, a professor of philosophy. By means of what became known as the White Rose Letters, they carried out their anti-Nazi propaganda in other universities. They were also in touch with the plotters in Berlin. One day in February 1943, the Gauleiter of Bavaria, Paul Giesler, to whom the Gestapo had brought a file of the letters, convoked the student body, announced that the physically unfit males, the able-bodied had been drafted into the army, would be put to some kind of more useful war work, and with a leer suggested that the women students bear a child each year for the good of the fatherland. "If some of the girls," he added, "lack sufficient charm to find a mate, I will assign each of them one of my adjutants, and I can promise her a thoroughly enjoyable experience." The Bavarians are noted for their somewhat coarse humor, but this vulgarity was too much for the students. They howled the Gauleiter down and tossed out of the hall the Gestapo and SS men who had come to guard him. That afternoon there were anti-Nazi student demonstrations in the streets of Munich, the first that had ever occurred in the Third Reich. Now the students, led by the Scholls, began to distribute pamphlets openly calling on German youth to rise. On February 19th, a building superintendent observed Hans and Sophia Scholl hurling their leaflets from the balcony of the university and betrayed them to the Gestapo. Their end was quick and barbaric, hailed before the dreaded People's Court, which was presided over by its president, Roland Freisler, perhaps the most sinister and bloodthirsty Nazi in the Third Reich after Heydrich. He will appear again in this narrative. They were found guilty of treason and condemned to death. Sophia Scholl was handled so roughly during her interrogation by the Gestapo that she appeared in court with a broken leg, but her spirit was undimmed. To Freisler's savage browbeating, she answered calmly, "You know as well as we do that the war is lost. Why are you so cowardly that you won't admit it?" She hobbled on her crutches to the scaffold and died with sublime courage, as did her brother. Professor Huber and several other students were executed a few days later. This was a reminder to the conspirators in Berlin of the danger that confronted them at a time when the indiscreetness of some of the leaders was becoming a source of constant worry to the others. Goerdeler himself was much too talkative. The efforts of Popitz to sound out Himmler and other high SS officers on joining the conspiracy were risky in the extreme. The inimitable Weizsäcker, who after the war liked to picture himself as such a staunch resistor, became so frightened that he broke off all contact with his close friend Hassel, whom he accused, along with Frau von Hassel, of being unbelievably indiscreet, and whom he warned the Gestapo was shadowing. Hassel describes the painful scene in his diary. "He asked me to spare him the embarrassment of my presence," Hassel writes. "When I started to remonstrate, he interrupted me harshly." The von Hassel diaries, pages 256 to 257. Only when Weizsäcker was safely settled down in the Vatican later, as German ambassador there, did he urge the conspirators to action. "This is easy to do from the Vatican," Hassel commented. Weizsäcker survived to write his somewhat shabby memoirs. Hassel's diary was published after his execution. The Gestapo was watching a good many others, especially the breezy, confident Goerdeler. but the blow which it dealt the conspirators immediately after the frustrating month of March 1943, during which their two attempts to kill Hitler had miscarried, came, ironically, as the result not so much of expert sleuthing, but of the rivalry between the two intelligence services. The Wehrmacht's Abwehr and Himmler's RSHA, the Central Security Office, which ran the SS Secret Service, and which wanted to depose Admiral Canaris and take over his Abwehr. In the autumn of 1942, a Munich businessman had been arrested for smuggling foreign currency across the border into Switzerland. He was actually an Abwehr agent, but the money he had long been taking over the frontier had gone to a group of Jewish refugees in Switzerland. This was the height of crime for a German in the Third Reich to commit, even if he were an Abwehr agent. When Canaris failed to protect this agent, he began to tell the Gestapo what he knew of the Abwehr. He implicated Hans von Dohnányi, who, with Colonel Oster, had been in the inner circle of the plotters. He told Himmler's men of the mission of Dr. Josef Müller to the Vatican in 1940, when contact was made with the British through the Pope. He revealed Pastor Bonhoeffer's visit to the Bishop of Chichester at Stockholm in 1942 on a false passport issued by the Abwehr. He hinted at Oster's various schemes to get rid of Hitler. After months of investigation, the Gestapo acted. Dohnányi, Müller, and Bonhoeffer were arrested on April 5, 1943, and Oster, who had managed to destroy most of the incriminating papers in the meantime, was forced to resign in December from the Abwehr and placed under house arrest in Leipzig. Bonhoeffer, Dohnányi, and Oster were all executed by the SS on April 9, 1945, less than a month before Germany's capitulation. Their extinction seems to have been an act of revenge on the part of Himmler. Müller alone survived. This was a staggering blow to the conspiracy. Oster, a man such as God meant men to be, lucid and serene in mind, imperturbable in danger, as Schlabrendorf said of him, had been one of the key figures since 1938 in the attempt to get Hitler, and Dohnányi, a jurist by profession, had been a resourceful assistant. Bonhoeffer, the Protestant, and Müller, the Catholic, had not only brought a great spiritual force to the resistance, but had given an example of individual courage in their various missions abroad, as they were to do in their refusal, even after the torture which followed their arrests, to betray their comrades. But most serious of all, with the breakup of the Abwehr, the plotters lost their cover, and the principal means of communication with each other, with the hesitant generals and with their friends in the West. Some further discoveries by Himmler's sleuths put the Abwehr and its chief, Canaris, out of business altogether within a few months. One sprang out of what came to be known in Nazi circles as the Frau Zolfti Party, which took place on September 10, 1943. Frau Anna Zolf, the widow of a former colonial minister under Wilhelm II, who had also served as ambassador to Japan under the Weimar Republic, had long presided over an anti-Nazi salon in Berlin. To it came often a number of distinguished guests, who included Countess Hanna von Bredow, the granddaughter of Bismarck, Count Albrecht von Bernstorff, the nephew of the German ambassador to the United States during the First World War, Father Erxleben, a well-known Jesuit priest, Otto Kiep, a high official in the Foreign Office, who once had been dismissed as German Consul General in New York for attending a public luncheon in honor of Professor Einstein, but who eventually had got himself reinstated in the diplomatic service, and Elisabeth von Taden, a sparkling and deeply religious woman who ran a famous girls' school at Weiblingen, near Heidelberg. To the tea party at Frau Zolf's on September 10th, Fräulein von Taden brought an attractive young Swiss doctor named Rexe, who practiced at the Charité Hospital in Berlin under Professor Sauerbruch. Like most Swiss, Dr. Rexe expressed bitter anti-Nazi sentiments, in which he was joined by the others present, especially by Kiep. Before the tea party was over, the good doctor had volunteered to carry any letters which Frau Zolf or her guests wished to send to their friends in Switzerland, German anti-Nazi émigrés and British and American diplomatic officials, an offer which was quickly taken up by more than one present. Unfortunately for them, Dr. Rexe was an agent of the Gestapo, to whom he turned over several incriminating letters as well as a report on the tea party. Count von Molke learned of this through a friend in the Air Ministry who had tapped a number of telephone conversations between the Swiss doctor and the Gestapo, and he quickly warned his friend Kiep, who tipped off the rest of the Zolf Circle. But Himmler had his evidence. He waited 4 months to act on it, perhaps hoping to widen his net. On January 12th, everyone who had been at the Tea Party was arrested, tried, and executed, except Frau Zolf and her daughter, the Countess Ballerström. Apparently Himmler had widened his net in the intervening 4 months. According to Reitlinger, some 74 persons were arrested as the result of Dr. Rex's spying. Reitlinger, the SS, page 304. The Zolfs were confined at the Ravensbrück concentration camp and miraculously escaped death. First, the Japanese ambassador intervened to delay their trial. Then, on February 3, 1945, a bomb dropped during a daylight attack by the American Air Force not only killed Roland Freisler while he was presiding over one of his grisly treason trials, but destroyed the dossier on the Zolfs, which was in the files of the People's Court. They were nevertheless scheduled to be tried by this court on April 27th, but by that time the Russians were in Berlin. Actually, the Zolfs were released from Moabit prison on April 23rd, apparently because of an error. Wheeler Bennett, Nemesis, page 595, note, and Pechel, Deutscher Widerstand, pages 88 to 93. Count von Moltke, implicated with his friend Kiep, was also arrested at this time. But that was not the only consequence of Kiep's arrest. The repercussions spread as far as Turkey and paved the way for the final liquidation of the Abwehr and the turning over of its functions to Himmler. Among Kiep's close anti-Nazi friends were Erich Vermehren and his stunningly beautiful wife, the former Countess Elisabeth von Plettenberg, who, like other opponents of the regime, had joined the Abwehr and who had been posted as its agents in Istanbul. Both were summoned to Berlin by the Gestapo to be interrogated in the Kiep case. Knowing what fate was in store for them, they refused, got in touch with the British Secret Service at the beginning of February 1944, and were flown to Cairo and thence to England. It was believed in Berlin, though it turned out not to be true, that the Vermehrens had absconded with all the Abwehr's secret codes and handed them over to the British. This was the last straw for Hitler, coming after the arrests of Dohnányi and others in the Abwehr and coupled with his growing suspicion of Canaris. On February 18, 1944, he ordered that the Abwehr be dissolved and its functions taken over by RSHA. This was a new feather in the cap of Himmler, whose war against the Army Officer Corps went back to his faking charges against General von Fritsch in 1938. It deprived the armed forces of any intelligence service of their own. It enhanced Himmler's power over the generals. It was also a further blow to the conspirators, who were now left without any secret service whatsoever through which to work. Canaris was made chief of the Office for Commercial and Economic Warfare. With the assumption of this empty title, the Little Admiral faded out of German history. He was so shadowy a figure that no two writers agree as to what kind of man he was or what he believed in, if anything much. A cynic and a fatalist, he had hated the Weimar Republic and worked secretly against it, and then turned similarly on the Third Reich. His days, like those of all the other prominent men in the Abwehr save one, General Lahausen, were now numbered, as we shall see. They had not ceased trying to kill Hitler. Between September 1943 and January 1944, another half-dozen attempts were organized. In August, Jakob Wallenberg had come to Berlin to see Gerdler, who assured him that all preparations were now ready for a coup in September, and that Schlabrendorf would then arrive in Stockholm to meet a representative of Mr. Churchill to discuss peace. "I was awaiting the month of September with great suspense," the Swedish banker later told Alan Dulles. "It passed without anything happening." A month later, General Stief, the sharp-tongued hunchback to whom Tresco had sent the two bottles of brandy, and whom Himmler later referred to as a little poisoned dwarf, arranged to plant a time bomb at Hitler's noon military conference at Rostenburg, but at the last moment got cold feet. A few days later, his store of English bombs, which he had received from the Abwehr and hidden under a watchtower in the headquarters enclosure, exploded, and it was only because an Abwehr colonel, Werner Schrader, who was in on the conspiracy, was entrusted by Hitler with the investigation that the plotters were not discovered. In November, another overcoat attempt was organized. A 24-year-old infantry captain, Axel von dem Busche, was selected by the conspirators to model a new army overcoat and assault pack which Hitler had ordered designed and now wanted to personally inspect before approving for manufacture. Busche, in order to avoid Gerstorff's failure, decided to carry in the pockets of his model overcoat two German bombs which would go off a few seconds after the fuse was set. His plan was to grab Hitler as he was inspecting the new overcoat and blow the two of them to pieces. The day before the demonstration, an Allied bomb destroyed the models, and Busche returned to his company on the Russian front. He was back at Hitler's headquarters in December for a fresh attempt with new models when the Führer suddenly decided to leave for Berchtesgaden for the Christmas holidays. Shortly afterward, Busche was badly wounded at the front, so another young frontline infantry officer was pressed into service to substitute for him. This was Heinrich von Kleist, son of Ewald von Kleist, the latter one of the oldest conspirators. The demonstration of the new overcoat was set for February 11, 1944, but the Führer, for some reason, Dulles says it was because of an air raid, failed to appear. The Kleists' father and son were later arrested. The father was executed on April 16, 1945. His son survived. By this time, the plotters had come to the conclusion that Hitler's technique of constantly changing his schedules called for a drastic overhauling of their own plans. Hitler often discussed this technique with his old party cronies. There is a stenographic record of a monologue of his at headquarters on May 3, 1942. "I quite understand," he said, "why 90% of the historic assassinations have been successful. The only preventive measure one can take is to live irregularly, to walk, to drive, and to travel at irregular times and unexpectedly. As far as possible, whenever I go anywhere by car, I go off unexpectedly and without warning the police." Hitler's Secret Conversations, page 366. Hitler had always been aware, as we have seen, that he might be assassinated. In his war conference on August 22, 1939, on the eve of the attack on Poland, he had emphasized to his generals that while he personally was indispensable, he could be eliminated at any time by a criminal or an idiot. In his ramblings on the subject on May 3, 1942, he added, "There can never be absolute security against fanatics and idealists. If some fanatic wishes to shoot me or kill me with a bomb, I am no safer sitting down than standing up." He thought, though, that the number of fanatics who seek my life on idealistic grounds is getting much smaller. The only really dangerous elements are either those fanatics who have been goaded to action by dastardly priests or nationalist-minded patriots from one of the countries we have occupied. My many years of experience make things fairly difficult even for such as these. Hitler's Secret Conversations, page 367. It was realized that the only occasions on which he could definitely be counted on to appear were his twice-daily military conferences with the generals of OKW and OKH. He would have to be killed at one of them. On December 26, 1943, a young officer by the name of Stauffenberg, deputizing for General Olbricht, appeared at the Rostenburg headquarters for the noon conference, at which he was to make a report on army replacements. In his briefcase was a time bomb. The meeting was cancelled. Hitler had left to have his Christmas on the Obersalzberg. This was the first such attempt by the handsome young lieutenant colonel, but not the last. For in Klaus Philipp Schenk, Count von Stauffenberg, the anti-Nazi conspirators had at last found their man. Henceforth he would not only take over the job of killing Hitler by his own hand in the only way that now seemed possible, but would breathe new life and light and hope and zeal into the conspiracy and become its real, though never nominal, leader.